the message comes eventually from ET, not phoning home but calling us, what should we do? In Oxford, lawyer Leah Triplett and physicist Peter Hatfield decided to run a referendum to ask 2,000 people what they thought we should do. And the results are fascinating. My first question to you about pros and cons, roughly speaking, what are the pros and cons about being in touch with ET?
The main dangers are that potentially alien life forms out there in the Milky Way are in some way hostile, that perhaps by sending a message out into the cosmos, we'd reveal Earth's location and maybe this hostile species would come and attack us in some way. Or maybe they don't even need to be hostile. They might just be so much more advanced to us that we'd kind of appear like ants to us, and they might do the equivalent of accidentally stepping on us. The pros are that maybe the aliens are friendly and that by engaging them with them, they might give us some new science and technology that would radically transform life on Earth for the better. Or maybe there's an interstellar community that Earth can kind of take its place at the table of. Some people would even speculate that maybe it's only possible for friendly aliens to become interstellar species. Maybe species that have a hostile nature destroy themselves in war before they even get to that stage. So there's lots of debates on both sides of the argument.
And Leo, why did you decide to have a sort of referendum of 2,000 people?
When thinking about what kinds of decision-making processes are most legitimate in deciding whether or not to message extraterrestrial life, it's important what the public perceive to be legitimate. The perceived legitimacy of decision-making processes are essential to the legitimacy they actually have, so we wanted to ask people what they thought.
And what results did you get with these 2,000 people?
We found that over half of the people who chose a decision-making process thought the decision should be made by scientists. And we think that's really interesting and hopeful that people see a leading role for scientists in the process of deciding whether to message extraterrestrial life. And then between the other options, we gave them three other options: elected representatives, a referendum, or a citizens' assembly. Slight preference for elected representatives, and then the referendum and a citizens' assembly were the least popular.
Now, what are you going to do, having found this, are you going to make decisions about referenda in general and whether they're effective and whether people need to be informed or what?
Yeah, I think we're going to use it to think about something that we haven't had before, about the process of international referendums and the challenges and also the opportunities that might go along with that and why that might be an unprecedented decision-making process for an unprecedented moment in humanity's history, this idea of contact with extraterrestrial life.
But the astronomers have in the past been rather leery about this. Stephen Hawking, for example, I mean, you're quoting him saying some fairly severe things about being in touch.
Yeah, Stephen Hawking, I think, was a strong proponent of the view that in the past, kind of clashes of civilizations haven't worked out particularly well and have been incredibly destructive in some circumstances. So potentially things will be even worse when we don't even kind of have humanity in common, so that we should be really careful. Other people would kind of say as well that we've only been in a position that we can even think about sending these messages over the last 100 years or so. Humanity's been around for 100,000 years. There's no harm in waiting 1,000 years. I'd say the majority, but not 100% of people take this kind of cautious view that we should be careful. But I think one of the things that I've been conscious is that scientists have realised that it's not just for us to make these decisions and be sending out the messages on our own authority, and that we can't do this unilaterally, and that it is important to think about how we would engage with the whole planet. And that's why we've had this interaction with the social scientists who are the experts in how to do decision making in large populations.
Well, you remember the case of Jocelyn Bell, actually, at your university. She was at Cambridge at the time, 50 years ago, and the pulsars came in, the most amazingly exact signals coming from outer space, the pulsars they turned out to be, and her professors got Nobel Prizes for doing that. But they kept it secret because they were scared that LGMs, or little green men, as they called them at that stage, might be in touch. So obviously, some scientists would want to keep it very secret just in case.
Absolutely. It's an incredible story of Professor Bell-Pinnell's work back then. And of course, pulsars have become an incredibly important feature of modern astrophysics. But that does show an important example of what message do you actually send that would cause aliens to identify as a message. People sometimes talk about, well, the pulsars is just a regular da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So maybe we'd do something like send up prime numbers. We'd do like a 2, then a 3, then a 5 and a 7. We would think of that as something important, but with aliens, maybe we can imagine that some kind of weird orbiting planets would produce that same signal. So even with the best one in the world, it's hard to come up with something that you know extraterrestrials would identify as from intelligent life form. In terms of people keeping it secret, I do think it is possible. I think an interesting sociological comparison was the LIGO, the gravitational wave detectors, detection of something with an optical source in, I think it was 2017, when they saw their neutron-neutron star merger. That was, to me, the closest we're going to get, in that LIGO saw this thing, and then all the other telescopes in the world were told to look at it at the same time. I wasn't involved with that, but I definitely heard rumours and knew that something interesting was happening before they had made the decision to release it. And they did their very best to keep that under wraps, but still the word got out. So I do think people will try, but I do think in a kind of internet-connected world, it would be quite hard to keep a real SETI detection secret.
If you can just imagine, I ask you, Leah, this, I'm sure you've thought about it, that if there is an announcement that we have been in touch with another civilization somewhere else, that won't just be banner headlines, because with gravitational waves, as you said, Peter, I mean, immense headlines, even though people didn't necessarily understand what they were, and still might not, you know, I find it difficult, you know, the some fraction of a proton being spotted at some huge distance. And yet it's going to be the most explosive question. And if you think about, may I mention Brexit, here is a friable atmosphere where people are concerned about, you know, foreigners coming over and immigrants, and this is a worldwide thing with populations all over moving. Is that the right time to have a vote?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I definitely think you're right. There's a fear, I have a worry that people would be extremely afraid if we had a message from extraterrestrial life, and indeed I think I would be frightened. We asked our respondents two questions. We asked them first which decision-making process would be most appropriate. And the second question we asked them was, if you received a message, should we respond? And more than half of our respondents did think that we should respond to such a message, which to me suggests that at least in theory, people would be hopeful and excited about receiving such a message from extraterrestrial life. But I think you're right that there is definitely a risk that we would go into full defense mode and it would be seen as a security problem rather than a humanitarian opportunity. And I think, to be honest, that's another reason for humanity to get its act together in advance. As Peter says, the chances of this happening are certainly higher than I expected. And so I think it's important to think in advance about how we might want to prepare as a species for this possibility.
10% in 100 years. Well, it's higher than I would have thought. But finally, Peter, you mentioned Voyager, and Voyager has left the solar system. And Tim Radford, who's written the most wonderful book called The Consolations of Physics, has talked about Voyager going on and on and on and probably not bumping into anything and outlasting our own civilization. So just imagine this message from us going on for thousands and perhaps millions of years, and once it's found, we don't exist anymore.
I think it's a fantastic thought. When people made these probes and sent them out, it was the height of the Cold War. People thought the world really could end the next day. And it really was on people's minds that these little messages on the Voyager probes could be all that's left of humanity. So I think it is really important to choose something that we think is valuable. And it's very difficult to do that, taking in all of civilization. Some of the messages we've sent out will only reach their intended location in tens of thousands of years. The Arecibo message is beamed at a globular cluster that I think is something like 20,000 light years away. Who knows what will be happening on Earth if it's even around in 20,000 years.
Leah Triplett and Peter Hatfield in Oxford. She is a lawyer, he a physicist. What do you think? Should we reply and risk the consequences? I would. Now, next week, we tackle the fourth largest international problem with a substance of addiction. What do you imagine that might be?
It would be without controversy to say that the three most commonly consumed addictive substances in the world are caffeine in coffee and tea, alcohol in alcoholic beverages, and nicotine in tobacco products. Now, I ask the listener to briefly set aside their cup of caffeine, their cocktail and or cigar, and consider what is the fourth most commonly consumed drug of addiction in the world.
Marijuana, cocaine, amphetamine, heroin, and ecstasy, one of those.
Sorry, not even close. Time for some facts. According to the 2017 annual report from the United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime, globally, there are less than 20 million users of each of cocaine, opium, heroin, or ecstasy. Global amphetamine users are estimated to be about 36 million. And not one country in the world has more than 3% of their population use any of these drugs within a year. Cannabis is more popular, with 183 million global users, but still well behind the fourth most commonly consumed addictive substance, which is betel quid.
A report from Peter Osborne in Taiwan. Such a huge problem, so little being done. In Papua New Guinea, it's an epidemic. Production today by David Fisher and Imris Cronin. And a fond farewell to Mark Don, whose name you'll have heard so many times at the end of our best programmes. He's off after so long with the ABC. He's a musical aficionado, so who better than a singer aged 102 to serenade him? Vera Lynn. I'm Robin Williams.
Smiling through just